Should people who work for a company in Massachusetts but live in New Hampshire continue to pay income tax here if they're working from home? That's one of the unexpected questions raised by the coronavirus pandemic as schools and hospitals brace for a possible second wave, and many of us continue to work from home for longer than we ever imagined. So we begin today by diving into that tax question. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a former commissioner of revenue for Massachusetts. But first, we want to go north of the border to our sister station, New Hampshire Public Radio. Todd Bookman is a senior reporter there, and he joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston, Todd.
Hi, Jamie.
So that question that we asked there right at the top seems to have bubbled up based on reporting by the union leader on Sunday. Explain that. Was this something that New Hampshire's leaders hadn't considered until Sunday?
I do think that this caught most people off guard. In March, when Massachusetts announced this emergency order, it did not make major news here in New Hampshire. There may have been people who were commuting who may have noticed that regulatory change, but no, this was certainly not something that people had been talking about until just this week.
So, okay, what's the real issue here? What did Massachusetts do in March to now, in August, get the attention of New Hampshire's leaders?
Sure. So previously, anybody who commuted into Massachusetts could deduct a portion of their taxable income that would be put towards the Massachusetts income tax. So let's say you're a New Hampshire commuter and you were commuting in 4 out of 5 days. On that fifth day, maybe you worked from home. Massachusetts would allow you to deduct essentially 1/5 of your taxable income towards the Massachusetts state income tax. And if you're in New Hampshire, where there is no income tax, that of course was a big benefit. And then in March, sort of at the start of the pandemic, we had this wave of people being told to work from home, and Massachusetts essentially rescinded this deduction policy. It essentially said if you are now working from home out of state, you are still sort of on the hook for Massachusetts income tax for that revenue, assuming that you are working for a Massachusetts-based company. And so this is what happened in March, and again, it didn't really get any attention until this week when the union leader reported on this topic. And now we've got a public hearing on the issue. The Massachusetts Department of Revenue is going to have a public hearing later in August on whether to continue this policy moving forward.
So this change, if it sticks, how many New Hampshire people could be affected by it?
That's a really good question. We don't have great numbers. Some estimates say around 100,000 people commute every day from New Hampshire into Massachusetts. That's, of course, pre-pandemic. We really don't have a good sense of how many people may be working from home right now, but it's clearly a lot of people. And so we're talking about a lot of people working at home for a lot of months and potentially longer. And so the dollar values here really could add up.
So you mentioned that the Massachusetts Department of Revenue is having a hearing on this later in the month. But what's New Hampshire's Governor Chris Sununu and the legislature there doing, or what are they saying on this issue?
Sure. So this week, the governor ordered our attorney general, the New Hampshire Attorney General, to essentially review what Massachusetts is doing, to investigate what is happening nationwide on this topic, and to see if states are following the law, if they're following their own tax policies, and to see if there's any potential U.S. sort of federal tax code violations here. It's unclear when the New Hampshire Attorney General might sort of release his findings or what may come of them. But at this point, that's what's been ordered, simply a review of these policies.
Yeah. So what role does the federal government play in these kind of tax squabbles between the states? Is there any federal tax law here that could come into play?
You know, I haven't seen any reporting on that issue just yet. There doesn't appear to be any on the surface, but, the attorney general may discover something that certainly could be relevant.
So, Todd, I grew up in the Merrimack Valley of Massachusetts, and this strikes me as not the first time that New Hampshire and Massachusetts have maybe come to blows over tax policy. I remember hearing sort of far-fetched stories of Mass state troopers waiting at the border to bust sales tax evaders. Is that a real thing that's happened in the past? Is this a real is there a history here of clashing between New Hampshire and Massachusetts on tax issues?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And New Hampshire politicians love these fights for obvious reasons. We know about the sales tax issue. New Hampshire, along with not having an income tax, it also doesn't have a sales tax. And last decade, this issue bubbled up involving a town fair tire on the border where folks from Massachusetts were coming up, getting their tires done. And there was a major fight between the two states about whether or not sales tax needed to be paid. New Hampshire has gone all the way to the Supreme Court to challenge internet sales tax applications, lost that fight about two summers ago. And then there have long been simmering tensions about New Hampshire's tax-free liquor sales and people coming from other states, you know, sometimes buying extremely large quantities of booze and moving it across state borders, potentially in violation of other states' tax policies. So, yeah, this is not new to New Hampshire, and folks here take it really seriously.
So, Todd, where does this go from here?
Well, we're going to have this public hearing on August 27th. The Massachusetts Department of Revenue is considering whether or not to extend this rule through the end of 2020. Unclear when the New Hampshire Attorney General may reveal sort of his findings and opinion on this. But I think that public hearing should be an interesting flashpoint. We'll see a lot of people, I assume we'll see a lot of people from New Hampshire chime in and give their take on whether or not they think this is fair.
Chime in remotely from home, right? New Hampshire Public Radio senior reporter Todd Bookman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So we want to dig in more into what this could mean for Massachusetts, and for that, we want to turn to Amy Pitter. She's president and CEO of the Massachusetts Society of CPAs and the former Commissioner of Revenue for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Amy, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Jamie. Nice to be here.
Thanks for doing it. So you were listening into that conversation, and so I just want to start by asking you what your reaction is to this bristling, if I can call it that, by New Hampshire.
Well, interesting stuff for sure. You know, the issue of withholding and interstate withholding and interstate telecommuting is complicated, and was, like everything else, made more complicated by COVID. So in March, CPAs and other groups started begging states basically to provide guidance, because the employers need guidance to be able to properly withhold and properly follow state rules. So what happened around the country at that point was you had sort of three or four responses. One response is there are still a lot of states there who haven't provided guidance and businesses are kind of on their own. We've had a couple of states say to employers, do whatever's easiest for you. And then the rest of the majority were kind of split between employers, states like Massachusetts, who basically said, look, what we want to do is pretend this is not happening. We want to create a fiction to say, let's maintain the status quo, do everything exactly the same way we did it pre-COVID, so that we're not requiring employers to jump through a lot of very complicated hoops and sort of rejig all of their systems and their payroll systems for something that's only going to be in place for a number of months.
But Amy, you could see how pretending that this doesn't exist could cause some concern for folks who live in New Hampshire and it could end up costing them a lot more money.
Well, just to be clear, nothing has changed, right? So the person who was driving in from Nashua and paying their tax on Monday is now telecommuting in from Nashua and paying their tax on Tuesday. And then when the crisis is over, they'll go back to driving in. And so,
right. But nothing, you say nothing has changed, but they're not driving in anymore. That's what's changed, right?
So that's what's changed. So the alternative would be to say, let's force employers and let's force payroll companies to make these massive changes for just a few months. So employers would hate this if you went the other way. And as I said, it's the employees aren't losing money. All they're doing is paying the same taxes in the same way as they've been paying it all along. Now, Massachusetts has recently superseded their first tax directive back in April with a new one in July, which is, I think, probably what New Hampshire noticed, to say, you know what, we can't do this forever, right? The crisis is lasting longer than we thought it would. So it all ends on December 31st.
Yeah,
So
we actually reached out to the Department of Revenue and they declined to participate with us today, but they did give us some information, including a statement from a spokesperson saying that yes, these rules are temporary and as proposed would not extend beyond 2020. But as we know, as with everything in this pandemic, everything is so uncertain. And so what happens if these employees remain work from home employees beyond
Exactly.
2020?
So if they do and these rules expire, then they're going to be treated like pre-COVID telecommuters, and they'll go ahead and if they're New Hampshire, won't be withheld upon, and if they're from some other state, there'll be a withholding obligation for that other state.
So, Amy, I want to ask you about the income implications here for the state. If New Hampshire successfully challenges this, or if we enter that new phase next year, how big of a hole could something like this blow in the Massachusetts budget?
So, first of all, I'm not sure what it means for New Hampshire to challenge this exactly. I think people who have a standing to challenge this are individual employees who might say to their employer, "Look, you've been illegally withholding because I'm home in Nashua and you have no right to withhold." So that would be, I think, the only way this gets challenged in court. So then, yeah, there would be a whatever it is, somewhere between 6 and 9 months worth of tax withholding that would be refunded to that taxpayer. I don't know the overall impact on the budget, depending upon, I guess, how many taxpayers decided that, that this was worth suing over. What New Hampshire itself can do for Massachusetts, I really can't picture that. What a state-to-state lawsuit would look like here. As I say, I don't know what their beef would be.
Got it. But potentially, there could be lost revenues here in Massachusetts.
Potentially. I mean, I have to say, I think Massachusetts is on pretty firm ground here. There are states like New York that have a convenience of the employer rule, and they can basically tax telecommuters if they're telecommuting by mutual agreement that telecommuting is better for the employee and employer. And then they can just go ahead, New York can just go ahead and tax that person who's commuting from Pennsylvania or New Jersey or wherever. So, and from the COVID standpoint, Massachusetts is well within the mainstream. I'd say most states that are doing anything are doing this, and not most like 90%, most like 55%. This is the way they're going
Well,
because it would be so burdensome to employers to go the other way.
we'll just,
By the way,
yeah.
when employers incur costs, those costs are either passed on to consumers or employees. So somebody's paying.
Somebody's paying. Well, we'll find out who will be left holding the bill, I suppose, by the end of the year. Amy Pitter is president and CEO of the Massachusetts Society of CPAs, and she's the former commissioner of revenue for the state of Massachusetts. Amy, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jamie. Bye.
We're less than a month away from the September primary, and with mail-in voting and early voting days, we're even closer than that. And if you've turned on your TV or logged on to YouTube recently, you've probably been bombarded by local campaign ads.
Remember where you come from. Stand up for people counting on you, and always be a leader in the fight for justice. I'm Ed Markey, and that's why I approve this message.
Together, we will recover. And when this crisis has passed, hear me loud and clear. Quality healthcare will be a guaranteed right for all. In the U.S. Senate, I will lead that fight. I'm Joe Kennedy, and I approve this message.
Two samples of official ads there from Ed Markey and Joe Kennedy in their primary race for the Senate. But then there's also Super PAC money and their ads, and who's behind those? And are these ads at all working? And what do they tell us about the state of a number of races during a pandemic? To help us answer those questions, let's turn to John Carroll. He's WBUR's senior news analyst, the man behind CampaignOutsider.com, and a recovered ad man. John Carroll, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Jamie. Good to be here.
So, first, what did you hear in that little sample there of Kennedy and Markey? Good political ad making? And since we ask you this question all the time, what makes a good political ad?
Well, the Markey ad, for one thing, is trying to convince voters that he's not an absentee senator. It's basically filmed with him walking around Malden. the idea that, you know, you put out your credentials is something that is a basic of advertising. There are three kinds of ads, basically. There are biography ads, there are issue ads, and there are attack ads. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen the third group in this race between Markey and Joe Kennedy the third, but we've seen basically a lot of issue-oriented ads, and both of them are put in the same issues, the same positions.
Yeah.
That's one of the difficulties in this race overall.
John Carroll, we're having a little bit of trouble hearing you here. We're gonna carry forward, but if we lose you, we'll get you back. So I do want to dive a little deeper then into this Senate race between Congressman Joe Kennedy and incumbent Senator Ed Markey. And I want to play another clip here. It's a digital ad that Kennedy aired recently that got a lot of attention. Let's listen to just a shortened version of that ad.
When I decided to run for office, I heard it all.
You don't get how it's done around here.
You don't have a good reason.
You're too young.
You don't have the experience.
Take a seat.
Wait your turn.
Slow down.
Calm down.
Pipe down.
And why tackle an incumbent?
That's why I'm with Joe Kennedy.
Why I'm with Joe Kennedy.
I'm with Joe Kennedy.
Because he speaks to the urgency,
the frustration,
and the passion of the rising generation.
He gets that voters nowadays expect more from people in Washington.
So, John Carroll, what do you say? Effective ad?
It could be effective if Joe Kennedy actually backed outsiders in other campaigns, but he didn't. He didn't back Ayanna Pressley when she challenged Mike Capuano. He didn't back a couple of other Rachel Rawlings in her run for DA. So it's a problem because he doesn't really have or has not been able to establish a real strong rationale for his challenge to Ed Markey, except generational change. And I think that position is not really resonating with a whole lot of voters because they think Ed Markey has done a good job in the issues that they care about.
Well, and I think it's maybe also worth noting this idea of waiting your turn, as our executive producer said today, waiting your turn for a Kennedy means one thing. It's like saying to Prince Charles, wait your turn for the throne, right?
True. But he's not campaigning against the Queen.
Well, let's see how Ed Markey, certainly not the Queen, responds. We have a little bit of an ad here featuring Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
The problems we are facing today of systemic injustice and inequality require strong, progressive leaders. And Ed Markey is that champion. He was an original co-sponsor of Medicare for All. He co-authored the Green New Deal with me last year, and he is a stalwart champion for racial justice. When it comes to progressive leadership, it's not your age that counts. It's the age of your ideas. And Ed Markey is the leader that we need.
So what do you think of that, John? Is that a good response to the Kennedy ad there?
Yeah, I think it takes the issue head on, basically undermining the whole idea of generational change, because what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is saying is it doesn't matter how old you are. It matters what your ideas are. And Joe Kennedy has come to Medicare for All a little late. I'm not sure he's on board with the Green New Deal. She's essentially trying to neutralize that aspect of this campaign, which is really the strongest issue that Kennedy has, is like, I'm a lot younger than you are.
Right. So let's talk about the money here in this race before we move on to another one. Just how much money is being spent on the Senate race here in Massachusetts?
Well, you're talking about millions at this point. I mean, Joe Kennedy went up in early May, and he's been on the air ever since then, and he'll stay on the air until September 1st. Just in that first ad, the Malden ad with Ed Markey, he's spent $345,000 on just that run over 5 days. So we're seeing significant money, but we're also seeing significant money from the outside groups.
Super PACs, right?
Right. There are two environmental groups that are going to spend over $1 million combined for Ed Markey. There's a new leadership PAC that is formed to support Joe Kennedy, they're up to about $2.5 million that they're going to spend on advertising. So those are significant aspects of this race. There was an attempt to keep super PACs out, the so-called People's Pledge, but it didn't work out. Ed Markey said, you know, as long as they're positive ads, it should be okay. Joe Kennedy said, well, that doesn't really work at all. And so neither one of them is actually trying to avoid having outside groups come in and influence the race.
And John, I just want to note that Joe Kennedy does support the Green New Deal. Okay, so on the money part of this, is this amount of money and amount of super PAC spending, as you just mentioned, is this typical for this time in this type of primary, or is nothing typical right now with the pandemic?
I think there are instances where super PACs have come into a primary like this, but I think that this is unusual because there's no basically retail campaign. Mm-hmm. There's very little of the candidates going out and meeting people. So they're relying more and more on advertising to deliver their message because they're not really getting news coverage of major events because they're not having major events.
So, John, I want to move on to the 4th District, which there are 9 Democrats and 2 Republicans running to fill Kennedy's seat. Let's listen to a few of their ads.
No civilian needs a weapon of war, and this Marine will fight Trump to ban them. I'm Jake Auchincloss, and I approve this message.
I refuse to allow Congress to offer thoughts and prayers after every shooting, but fail to do anything to stop the next one. I'm Becky Grossman, and I approve this message.
I'm running for Congress to fight for social and economic justice. I'm Issan Leckie. I approve this message because it's time to change the face of Congress.
Alan Kazee's running for Congress because he knows the only way to change a system that shuts people out is to bust the door down and let them back in.
So, John, that wasn't even everybody, but anyone stand out to you in that?
Well, let me just preface this by saying the ads in this campaign are really important. In June, there was a survey that came out that said 60% of the voters in the 4th district were undecided. So that's a lot of minds to get made up. And so it's more important, I think, than usual for these ads to try to break through all the clutter. I think the Jake Auchincloss is spending the most money, as far as I can tell. His parents have also set up a super PAC to support him. I think he's basically trying to dominate the airwaves in terms of this particular race. The other candidates are trying to keep up with him. I'm not sure that that any of them really can match him dollar for dollar.
So I can't help but be reminded of the race for the 3rd district up in the Merrimack Valley. Does this remind you of that race where there were so many candidates running and it was a sort of, you know, close race to the end there, and then ultimately Lori Trahan prevailed?
Yeah, I think in that case, they were able to go out and do retail campaigning, so that helped. And Lori Trahan had connections to the district that the other candidates didn't. In this case, most of the major candidates running in the 4th district are from Newton or Brookline. So, but you know, this district goes all the way down to what, Fall River, mm-hmm. And so there's a big gap there that is not filled by sort of the local favorite. None of these candidates are really the local favorite if you look at the district overall. So I think that's one of the big differences between the two.
And I do want to move on to one more race. I just want to ask quickly, you mentioned money. How important is it going to be in this race?
It's pretty important because essentially you have to introduce yourself. These are virtual unknowns, except for Alan Kazee, who ran for governor, I believe, before. But I think, you know, the most of these candidates are starting from zero. So they really need to make an impression. They really need to get on the radar screen of the public before they go into the voting booth or mail in their ballot.
Alan Kazee, candidate for many offices, we believe here. So, John, I want to ask you about another race that's getting a lot of attention. It's the race for the first district in Massachusetts. It's getting attention because for a number of reasons, including the sort of progressive upsets that we've been seeing in this cycle, Cori Bush, Jamal Bowman, Marie Newman, among others. It's where longtime incumbent Richard Neal is facing a progressive challenge from Holyoke Mayor Alex Morse. Neal, the powerful chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, serving in Congress since 1989. Morse is openly gay, 31 years old, he's the mayor of Holyoke. What stands out to you in this race?
What stands out to me is the vulnerability of Richie Neal at this point. Alex Morse is trying to tie him to corporate interests, to the financial services industry, basically to say that he is not doing the people's business. He's doing the business of corporate America. Richie Neal, I think, is hearing footsteps pretty significantly. He just released an ad with Nancy Pelosi endorsing him. And I think that that's an indication of how seriously he is taking this challenge.
So actually, John, we have that ad. So we're going to hear first that ad from Richard Neal, and then I want to hear a Morse ad from the end of July.
When I needed someone to lead the fight against Donald Trump, I asked Richie Neal, because he doesn't back down from anyone. When COVID-19 struck, I trusted Richie to negotiate the best deal for working people. And Richie delivers for his district. He delivered over $1 billion for Western and Central Massachusetts. If we're going to beat Trump, I need a leader like Richie in the fight.
I'm Richie Neal, and I approve this message.
And here's an Alex Morse ad that came out at the end of July in which he talked about losing his brother to opioid addiction.
Earlier this year, we lost my brother after a long struggle with opioid addiction. Doug was a good man, but he fell through the cracks of our broken and cruel healthcare system. Too many families in Western Mass know that same pain. It's why, as mayor, I started programs to treat addiction and save lives. But in Washington, instead of standing up for patients, Richie Neal is using his power and seniority to fight for the same drug companies that are fueling this crisis. I'm running for Congress to fight for people like my brother. I'm Alex Morse, and I approve this message.
John, I got to say, both of those ads make a very compelling case.
They do on the surface. I think there's a critique of the Pelosi ad that says, you know, Richie Neal was not out in front of the fight against Donald Trump. He held back as the Ways and Means chairman calling for Donald Trump's tax returns until he got a law passed, a bipartisan retirement security bill passed that the insurance industry was pretty happy about. He also, when they were looking to help working people, he never went to raise corporate taxes that Donald Trump had cut so much. Those are the critiques of him and of this particular ad as well, that, you know, he has not been a leader that way. On the flip side, Alex Morse has taken a lot of criticism for his handling of the mayoral position in Holyoke. He, you know, his record has been a little bit up and down. Some people say very up and down. And so he's vulnerable in that area. Yeah. One of the issues here is how much people sort of examine and scrutinize these ads. If you just take them at face value, they're probably reasonably effective. If you dig into them a little bit, you know, sometimes they're less so.
So, John, in just our last 30 seconds here, I just want to note, so we have reached out to Alex Morse and Richard Neal to join us on Radio Boston. And so we will announce that when we have it squared away. But in our final 30 seconds here, John, I just want to finally ask what you think the weight of the TV ads this season are, given the pandemic.
I think they're more important than they might otherwise be, because there are so few pipelines of communication for the candidates to reach the public. Television has always been the big megaphone. And so, you know, it's going to be the most effective way to reach as many people as possible that these candidates will have.
John Carroll is WBUR senior news analyst. John, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. Marriage, the joys of wedding season. This time of year is usually prime time for celebrating unions of all kinds. But for many couples, of course, the pandemic has meant a slow fade-out of their original wedding plans. With large gatherings mostly banned, as they pose a big health risk, how do you plan a wedding? And when the celebrations slow down, what does that mean for the wedding industry? So for the rest of this hour, we're going to take your calls. Are you planning a wedding in the midst of this pandemic? Have you had to downsize or postpone your wedding? Or have you gone through it despite the risk? Are you a guest debating whether or not you should attend a wedding? And because the wedding industry encompasses so many different businesses, we also want to hear from the folks who make these celebrations happen. Wedding planners, caterers, florists, venues, DJs, video and photographers, call us. Everyone's invited. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Joining us for today's conversation is Mandy Connors. She's the owner and lead planner at Hummingbird Bridal and Events. Welcome to Radio Boston, Mandy.
Hi, Jamie. How are you?
I'm good. Also joining us is Meredith Goldstein. She's the person behind the Boston Globe's Love Letters column and podcast. Meredith, welcome back to you.
Hello.
So, Meredith, I want to start with you. You wrote about this early in the pandemic, about the uncertainty facing all of us, and especially those planning and working in weddings. How have things changed since the beginning of the pandemic?
Well, I think at the start of this, we just didn't know how long it was going to last. So people who had weddings in April were thinking about June, and that seemed possible then. Of course, as the weeks went on, it started to think, it seemed like, oh, well, maybe this is going to be a fall event, or maybe this is being pushed back a year. So at the time, I interviewed wedding planners and people in the industry, people, stationers, you know, people who were putting out save the dates, you know, in some cases with big question marks on them.
And like literal question mark. Though.
Literal, like here's a plan B, here's a plan C. And at the time, a lot of the planners were telling me, you know, we need people to be flexible. We also suspect that 2021 is going to be very busy. And part of that might mean having weddings on Fridays, Thursdays, and maybe even Wednesdays. And as this, you know, I'll be curious to hear what a planner has to say, but as this year has gone on, as someone who's a frequent guest at weddings, I'm, you know, not married and have not had a wedding, but I love to be a good guest. I sort of like the idea that as we learn that we can work more flexibly, we can celebrate more flexibly. So, you know, I think people, as the year has gone on, people have said, oh, we're going to do this differently, or we're going to be really patient about waiting. The one big complaint I hear from people is that they're trying to get within a calendar year so that they can not lose out on deposits. So there is a financial piece of this, right? Like if they've already put down money, but you know, some people are really just saying, see you in 2022. Yeah. And if they can pull it off, you know, I think that's great. And it just seems like from what I've heard, the local wedding industry has been quite, you know, delightful about being flexible and trying to help couples as best they can.
So Mandy Connor, how about that?
Yeah, so we're obviously, it's an ever-changing landscape. And I'll tell you that as a wedding vendor, it is extremely challenging to keep up with the constant changing landscape. We're having to reinvent what a traditional wedding looks like. Obviously, with limitations on headcounts, not being able to have a dance floor, not being able to have a band, not being able to host a big bar, it really restricts the ways that we traditionally celebrate. So for us, we are having to pivot. And man, I am coming to hate that word. But we're having
to pivot
constantly to reinvent new ways to celebrate. We as humans love to celebrate big milestones. I don't see that changing anytime soon. But asking your guests, asking your couples, asking your vendors to reimagine how you see yourself celebrating this major milestone, it is taking a lot out of couples, but you're seeing a lot of people be very creative and very open-minded about how they're willing to celebrate such a big day.
1-800-423-8255 is the phone number. That's 1-800-423-TALK. How are you reimagining or rethinking your wedding in this time of COVID? Or how are you thinking about going to weddings as a guest? 1-800-423-8255. I do want to also ask you, Mandy, about that deposit issue that Meredith was talking about, because I know that finances is such a huge issue for anyone planning a wedding. And now for so many people who may be unemployed or underemployed or working from home, there's just so much financial strain out there. So how are you and other folks balancing that?
It's a very complicated issue. I mean, we could take a 3-hour show to really dive into all the intricacies of understanding how deposits work. This is a cottage industry of small businesses. You don't find mega businesses in the wedding industry. It's all artisans, boutique companies, small businesses. For small business owners, you have a very strict cash flow. Particularly with a seasonal business, we make all of our money in New England, essentially between May and October. Once October hits, you see a sharp decline in the number of weddings, and really that's the time that couples are spending planning for next year. So for small business vendors to be asked, you know, let's say the standard wedding photographer, if they've got cancellations coming in, we're not talking about people who are postponing. We're talking about couples who are outright canceling and coming back and saying, we'd like a full deposit refunded back to us. Who's got that kind of cash flow available to be refunding deposits of 30, 40 clients? I mean, we're talking, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in liquid assets for a small business to have available. That sort of request will put small businesses out of business overnight.
Yeah, so actually, and to that point, our producer, Paris Alston, spoke with Chrissy Price. She runs Boston Pollen and is a floral designer. And she said, she talked to us about how she and others are trying to stay afloat while being sensitive to the fact that this can be a hard financial time for clients.
One of the really important things that we discussed as an industry was trying to ask our clients to reallocate their budgets instead of reduce them, or to limit their reductions to 10% or less, so that we wouldn't lose income further.
So Meredith Goldstein from the Boston Globe, I mean, has this maybe given permission to folks to maybe scale back their expensive wedding plans were?
It really has. And I think part of that is that some tastemakers and influencers and celebrities, you know, we've seen this on Instagram this season, people who've posted a picture of themselves on their doorstep, you know, that they did this with just two people and the pictures are great from afar and that's all they did. And maybe it's a celebrity who might have had a very big wedding in a different time. So I do think that gives permission in the sense that suddenly it also feels like a trend. I mean, it's so funny because as an advice columnist who hears from people when they are unhappy in relationships, I have always had this idea that everyone should get engaged and then wait 5 years to get married. And if you still want to do it, go right ahead. So I love this idea that for some people, they are spending the money, they are not asking for that money back, and they are saying, you know what, we are willing to have a long engagement and wait, and we're going to celebrate when everybody's there.
I would also hope this pandemic is in 5 years long, Meredith.
Let's hope not. Let's hope not. Right. So, and sorry, don't want to scare anybody. I mean, I think what's also interesting, and Mandy, I would love to know what you think about this, is often the questions I get off the record are from family and friends who have been invited to an event and they feel as though health considerations aren't being taken. You know, what if I don't feel comfortable going? So how do you advise couples on how to make guests feel safe or not guilty if they can't go to something that is planned?
Well, I actually want to go to a caller here who is planning a wedding. We have Annie calling from Framingham. Annie, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. Hi, Meredith. I love your column. So I am calling to say that I found a hidden blessing in all of this. We're getting married next Saturday, so 10 days. We were originally going to have our wedding in a, thank you. We're originally going to have our wedding in a hall with 76 people. Now it's 17 people in my backyard. And the hidden blessing is that my dog can now be the ring bearer.
So you sound like a happy bride. So I guess you found the silver lining here, right, Annie?
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of people are doing what we're going to do. In 1 year, on the anniversary, we're going to have the actual party, hopefully, that we wanted, and we're going to renew our vows.
That's very sweet. Thanks for the call, Annie.
Thank you.
So, Mandy, but of course, then that means, you know, you don't need a wedding planner, right, if you're doing it in your backyard.
Absolutely. Certainly, you know, there, now is the time, once so many of the couples out there have gotten over the initial shock of having to move and readjust their weddings, there's a reevaluation. Where do your priorities lie? What do you really want to celebrate? I see a lot of couples embracing the concept of an elopement and a micro wedding. There used to be such a stigma attached to elopements, and we're seeing that actually elopements and micro weddings are something to really get excited about. I would say sit down with your significant other and reevaluate your priorities. You can have the greatest, most luxurious celebration you can possibly imagine if you're only hosting 20 people rather than 200. Imagine putting all of your budget into something that is completely over the top and completely memorable in every way, rather than hosting a really huge celebration where maybe you've got to make cuts and make negotiations because budget is a lot tighter when spread over 200 guests. So when I talk to my couples, when I talk to other couples out there, I'm encouraging you, reevaluate your priorities for the day. Maybe you want to elevate the luxury of the day. Maybe you want to elevate the situation. It really is a good opportunity to reevaluate how you think about celebrations.
So I actually want to hear some tape here from Josh Rezenkoff. He just got married last weekend to his wife, Michelle, and he talked to our producer, Paris Alston, about how much planning and communication with family had to go into pulling the wedding off.
You know, I can't stress enough, like, how many private conversations were had. Like, you don't want that one crazy cousin to show up who's like, hey, just here to get loose. And so there was a lot of family work that went into making sure that this was a safe event. Really take a lot of joy in the fact that you're going to celebrate this special moment, like this huge, huge transformative moment in your life, and that you get to share that with your nearest and dearest. Maybe not your nearest and dearest 300 friends.
1-800-423-8255. So Meredith Goldstein, this idea that you could have 100 people at a, depending on the venue, at an outdoor site, right? According to the governor's orders.
Yes.
But how do you, you know, let's say you have a big Italian family. How do you get that number to 100? And how do you negotiate, as Josh was talking about, with your family members about their safe behavior? And how do you just juggle all those things?
I mean, I think it's a time for real boundaries, because let's say you have a guest list of 100 and that's all you've ever wanted, but half of those people are high risk or perhaps don't feel comfortable coming. I think this is not the time for grudges. If you want to have your wedding, you have to accept that people might not want to be there live. They might want to be there on Zoom. They might want to celebrate with you at a later date. So I think, you know, what I keep telling people is no mind reading, no passive aggressiveness. If you're a couple and you're doing this, expect to hear some no's from people who love you dearly. And it has nothing to do with not loving you, not coming, you know, and so you have to be ready to, you know, be the central unit at the party, and whoever can feel comfortable coming, that's great. But it might not be everybody.
I want to go to one more caller here if we can fit them in. Tiffany is calling from Rowley. Tiffany.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
So we actually own a venue here in Raleigh, the Bradstreet Farm, and we've been working with our clients to successfully have a few weddings here under the guidelines and working really hard. And so one of the grooms just mentioned this, super important for communication. Can't stress it enough to communicate with the vendors, your guests, your family.
Yeah, how have you been doing, weddings, Tiffany?
Yeah, so we've been working with our local Board of Health agents very closely ever since this actually broke, started having communication conversations with them about what these guidelines were going to be. And obviously we didn't know until we knew. And then we just worked as a team to make sure that we could deliver it, and just had a clear line of communication and full transparency with our clients about what was allowed and what is not allowed, and then how we would pivot, you know, how we could do things, how we could give them the wedding that they were hoping for, within the bounds of the guidelines and doing so safely.
Have you taken a financial hit, Tiffany?
Absolutely. Yeah. We've gone down to just a handful of weddings, and we were supposed to have dozens and dozens and dozens this year.
Does that mean you had to cut staff?
Yeah, unfortunately. But we have an amazing team that's going to come back with us next year, and we're ready to roll next year as soon as we're allowed to do so.
Tiffany, thanks for the phone call.
That's okay. One of the things that I did want to mention, though, is just that there's a big difference in the industry and a continuing conversation about deposits versus payments.
Yeah.
And the planner did such a nice job about discussing deposits and such, but it's really important to note that a lot of us don't take deposits, we take payments.
Got it.
And so that's been an ongoing conversation that we've all had about how we deal with that.
Thank you. Thank you. We appreciate your phone call. You know, I can't help but keep thinking about these financial impacts and the jobs that are lost. And I know this is a huge industry. Meredith, you know, it's the DJs, it's the videographers, it's the photographers.
It's so many people. It's so many people. But here's one piece of good news I'll say. The research I've done about what happens after world events and natural disasters and things that really change us is that a lot of people get married. It's not just divorce statistics that go up. A lot of people get married. So I just keep thinking that when we come out of this, we might see far more marriages than we would have seen with great big weddings. And I hope so many people are employed as this happens. So that's what I keep holding on to for the industry, because I think it's such a wonderful, beautiful industry with so many talented artistic people. So it's what I'm holding on to.
Well, I want to squeeze in one more caller here if we can. Emily from Newton, if you could be very brief. Emily, go ahead.
Yeah, so my husband and I got married in my parents' backyard in Newton in May, and we had all of our guests on Zoom. And what was really great about it is that we really got to spend time with our close family and friends, and it was incredible. So encourage going with it in the crazy times.
Try something new, a wedding on Zoom. Thank you, Emily. In just our last few minutes here, yeah, where are you finding hope in all this? I know, Meredith, you just mentioned that, so Mandy Connor.
Yeah, so I think that this has given all of the artisans, all of the small business owners in the industry time to breathe, time to refocus ourselves on new services and new offerings. The wedding industry has been around for so long, and it was due for a shakeup. It was time for us to be challenged and to rethink how we can reimagine services that we offer clients. So this has, I think it has pushed creatives to be more creative, to think outside of the box, and to reimagine how we can honor your celebration in a time of a pandemic, you know, with loads of restrictions in front of us.
And it could be good for folks who, you know, maybe couldn't afford a wedding in the first place. Maybe now is the time to do it, right, Meredith?
Absolutely.
In our final moments here, Meredith Goldstein, I also just want to ask you, what do you say to that cousin who just won't give it up, just wants to come and wants to party?
Wear a mask.
wear a mask. Wash your hands.
Wash your hands, wear a mask, stay far away. You know, you can party alone many feet away.
All right, that's Meredith Goldstein. She is the woman behind the Boston Globe's Love Letters column and podcast. Meredith, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Mandy Connor, she's the owner and lead planner at Hummingbird Bridal and Events. Mandy, thank you so much as well.
Thanks so much, Jamie.